Welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Linda Lloyd, and it's my pleasure to welcome best-selling author Kimberly Bell. Her latest 3 Days Missing takes us into a parent's worst nightmare, the middle of the night call with the news a child is missing. The book is published by Park Row Books. Kimberly, thank you so much for being here with us today. Your new book, 3 Days Missing, starts out with Kat, who is a young single mother at this point, and her only child, Ethan, getting ready to go on an overnight camping trip. Now, right. Ethan is only, what, 7 years old,
He's in second grade, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So why do you think Kat let him go? Because as a mother and grandmother, I'm just going, would I really let a 7-year-old go? But she really wanted him to go on this trip.
Right. Well, so Ethan is an awkward kid, and he doesn't have a whole lot of friends at school, and she worries a lot about that part of him. And she really wants him to be like the other kids in the class. So when the permission slip came home, you know, she definitely paused, wasn't quite sure that she wanted him to go, but she let him go. And at the same time, she also was kind of praying that he would make a friend, maybe outside of the constraints of, you know, school and all the pressures there, that he would actually make a friend. So she let him go. And it was, you know, it was a class trip. The teachers were going with a couple of chaperones, and they promised to take really good care of the kids. So,
and she went out of her way to make this extra special, because she even bought him a special sleeping bag.
Exactly, yes.
Which plays highly into the story, yes, later down the line.
It does. It does. She's on the road to divorce. So she's a single mother and, you know, figuring out how she's going to run the household by herself. And money is tight. So it was a really special surprise for him before he got on the bus. Yes.
And then she gets the phone call. Actually, she gets a banging on the door.
Yes.
Because she's forgotten to take her cell phone,
exactly,
to bed with her.
Even worse, right? In the middle of the night. And I don't think you have to be a parent to put yourself in her shoes, what it would feel like to have someone banging on your door in the middle of the night with news of a loved one. So I think it's something that, you know, is universally recognizable, that kind of fear, especially when you send your kid away and you hear that in the middle of the night. It's definitely something that I think everyone can put themselves in that place and think, oh my gosh, if that happened to me, what would I do? How would that feel?
And I'm not sure I can imagine what that really would feel like.
Mm-hmm.
But this was gut-wrenching for her, because she starts questioning everything about her own mothering ability and,
right,
capabilities. She also felt like she might have had a premonition about,
right,
this trip.
Yes, yes. As she's putting him on the bus, she says something about, you know, a cold chill goes down my spine that almost makes me stop him. But she just, like I said, she really wants him to go and make a friend and be like all the other kids. That's all she wants for him. And he really wants it himself as well. So she feels that.
But this is a brilliant kid. I mean, he really is a genius.
He
and
is.
So instead of being a second grader, he's probably more on a level of a senior,
right,
in high school.
Right.
As far,
yes,
as what he knows and can understand.
Right. But emotionally, maybe not quite. But, you know, that's also part of the story later down the line. How much blame do you put on the school for not taking care of him, because he's being bullied in the classroom and he's not doing very well socially, and his teachers are maybe not protecting him the way that he needs to be protected from the other kids?
Well, there is one kid that is really his nemesis, Sammy.
Yes.
And Sammy really is a bully.
Yes, he is. Yes. And his parents are maybe not quite willing to go there and see the awful things that their son is doing. They're not ready to recognize that he is a bully.
There's a big contrast between those two mothers. And when you first meet Kat, Kat has had a very hard life.
Right.
She married somebody that maybe she shouldn't have in retrospect,
mm-hmm,
but she married him thinking that, oh, you know, I'm going to have a better life because,
right,
of this. And then Steph has always had it all.
Right.
And I think they refer to her as a political Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
Politician wife's Barbie or something,
right,
like that. But I found that fascinating.
Yeah. And I thought that, you know, made a really good dynamic, the difference between the two mothers and how one is going through this really public, really ugly divorce where everybody knows about it. And then on top of that, her kid is having troubles at school and then he goes missing. And then we have the other mother who, on the outside at least, looks picture perfect. She has money. She has looks. She's married to the mayor of Atlanta. She seems to have it all. But once you pull back her curtain and take a little peek inside, all is not as it seems in Steph's life either.
Do you think that they were more critical of Kat because of the situation that she had been in? She, as you referenced, she's going through this very political divorce in really an abuse situation.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I think everybody, especially when you don't know the person that well, if it's somebody just in your orbit and you don't really know them, I think there's always some judgment that goes on. And that definitely was at play here. I don't know if you can get around that, you know, the judging someone that you don't really know, even when you try not to. And it definitely played a part in this story as well, you know, the misconceptions that they had of Kat just because of what she was going through and who she used to be married to.
The police and Kat automatically suspect her soon-to-be ex-husband.
Right.
Is that fairly normal in this type of situation?
When Ethan went missing, Kat was going through this divorce where they were fighting for custody. There was a restraining order out against him. You know, he did this awful thing. He beat her in a way that was public and kind of made her come out of the closet about all this stuff that was going on behind the closed doors of their home. And for her, it was the last straw. That's when she decided she couldn't stay married to this guy anymore. So, you know, he was the obvious suspect from the very beginning, especially because of the custody battle. And when they called him after Ethan went missing, he wasn't answering his phone. So that automatically set him up as, you know, head suspect number one.
And Kat knows that if her friend Lucas can just get there. Tell us a little bit about Lucas, because he was an interesting character.
Yes, he was. I wanted to give her someone who would be 100% on her side. So when I came up with a character for Lucas, he is someone who had taken her in earlier in her life after her mother died. And so she trusted him 100%. And the only thing she thought was he needs to be here for this, you know, not to fix things, but just to be here for me. And she knew that she could trust him. So she called Lucas. He lives in Tennessee. So he drove down and he really took over and supported her while she was going through this awful 3 days.
I didn't think about, you know, him being her constant support because she really didn't have anybody else.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. Even the people that were around her trying to help find her son,
right.
She's feeling accused no matter what
yes.
she does.
Right. And she's feeling a lot of guilt for letting him go, even though everything inside of her was telling her to maybe call him back down off that bus. So she's feeling guilt for letting him go. She's feeling that she's maybe not made all the right choices in her path as being his mother. And, you know, she really needed someone there to support her 100%. And Lucas was the one.
Well, one of the things that she said was, the last time I saw Ethan, I didn't see Ethan.
Right, because she's looking at him through, like, smoky glass windows of the bus, and all she could see were, like, these shadows, I guess, of the kids' heads. Yeah.
Well, with something like that happening, don't you think you would second-guess everything that
yes.
you said or did up until the point where he got on the bus?
Absolutely, for sure. You know, and I'm a mother. I have two kids. Mine are bigger now. But, yeah, I can't even imagine. And, you know, as I was writing it, it did take me to some dark and kind of scary places. You know, because as the author, you always try to put yourself into your character's shoes. And it was hard.
And I guess as a parent or anybody who cares for children, that's one of the biggest fears, is something's going to happen on my watch.
Yes, absolutely.
And I don't understand the school's response, though. They don't really get in touch with the parents right away. Is that normal? I mean, were they just on blackout or?
I hope not. Well, part of it was that, you know, she had left her phone downstairs in the kitchen. So everybody had been calling and they couldn't get a hold of her until the policeman came to the door. But it's a fictional private school in Atlanta. It's not based on any of the private schools. And they were pretty much trying to cover their own track. It was their PR nightmare. And so they wanted to be very careful about how they handled it PR-wise. They didn't want to get blamed for it. So they didn't quite make all the right decisions when it came to the safety of Ethan and caring for his mother afterwards. So, yeah. Yeah, they were definitely to blame.
Yeah, and really in this situation, I mean, a fire started. Everybody was focused on the fire, not mm-hmm. necessarily on the children.
Right. The fire was what woke the kids up in the middle of the night and what drove everybody out of the cabin. And the police, as soon as they heard that part, they knew that, you know, it was an intentional, something was going down. And so they knew right away that was a big red flag that there was something very suspicious going on.
Well, they call out the dogs. Did you already know how that process worked when somebody goes missing, or did you have to learn all about that and how dog teams work and all of that? Because that was interesting.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I did a lot of research into that, and that's why I had it raining, because when it rains, it washes away a lot of the scent, and especially once you get to, I don't remember the details anymore, but once you get to a certain number of inches of rainfall, then there's nothing left to search for. So that was fascinating. I did a lot of research around that and what happens when a child goes missing and what are the steps that you take to find someone. How crucial are the first few hours when someone goes missing? And after a certain point, you're not searching for a live body anymore. You're really searching for something else, you know. So there's a lot out there in Google land. I read everything I could get my hands on, and then I talked to some people who were in law enforcement and did a lot of research around it. It's fascinating and terrifying.
Absolutely. And I was shocked by the number of children who go missing every year.
Yes.
I think it's 800,000.
Yeah, it's crazy. And most of those are found pretty quickly, and they're people that the kids know. So once you break down those statistics and then you get to, like in this case, you know, a real child kidnapping, those numbers are much, much smaller, but still, it's terrifying.
How does Steph react when she realizes that this may not be about Kat and her family?
So Steph is the other mother. She's the one who's married to the mayor of Atlanta. And she knows that her son is not a big fan of Ethan. So there's all that dynamic playing in the back of her brain, too, when she finds out that she may have some sort of connection to what happened to Ethan.
But more from the bullying aspect than anything else,
right? She's kind of in denial a little bit at first, and she doesn't really want to admit that her son is doing these awful things and doesn't want to see maybe how she's connected to Ethan's disappearance.
But then again, the sleeping bag comes into play. And it'd be so upsetting to find out that maybe the scent wasn't Ethan's because it was the wrong bag all the time.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how that would feel, you know, to know that there may have been hours wasted.
Right. When you found out that the dogs were following maybe the wrong scent and that you've wasted all those precious hours. Remember, I said that the first however many hours are the most crucial in a disappearance. And then you find out that maybe you've wasted it.
Was it difficult to write from Kat in first person and then as Steph in first person? Was that difficult to go back and forth? And
so hard.
Okay. I wondered about that.
Yeah. It was the first time I've ever done that, bounce back and forth. There were two equal perspectives in a story. And so when I first started, first of all, it took me almost twice as long as it takes me to normally write a book. It took me close to a year to write that book. And part of it was because I kept getting the voices mixed up. Because they're both women, even though they're very different, you know, I would write a chapter, which is, you know, 2,500 words, whatever. And then I would flip to the next chapter, because I like to write in order. And I would carry the voice through to the next chapter, even though it was a different woman. So it was really hard for me. And what I ended up doing, I made a really detailed outline of the chapters, what was going to happen in each, why. And then I wrote like three or four chapters in one perspective, a big chunk. And then I would go back and write the three or four chapters in the other and thread them through. So that way I wasn't flipping back and forth as often. And it was easier for me to stay in one woman's voice.
As you said, they are very different, but underneath, there's something that's very similar. Mm-hmm. Both are very strong, and if their children are involved, they become mother bears.
Right, yes. Well, they're both mothers, right? And they both really love their kids. And
they both own their only children.
Right.
Both boys are only children.
Right. And you always, as a mother, you always want to take up for your child, even when he's you know, maybe not being the nicest kid, because you see the side of him that is a nice kid, right? So you want to take up for him. So I think that in a lot of ways they're very similar, and maybe in other circumstances they could be friends even. It's just that this particular circumstance that they were put in kind of put them on opposite sides of the field.
There is a political aspect to it too. The mayor is running for election and is falling behind in the polls, I guess. Mm-hmm. But he has this one development. Was that a situation that you knew about, or you just made up about this mixed-use development and all that kind of stuff?
My husband's in real estate, so maybe that's where that came from. I was looking for a plot device for Steph's plot line that would kind of put her in between, like, I need to stand up for my son, I need to help figure out what happened to Ethan, and I also need to protect my husband because he's running for re-election. So that really gave her a lot of strings pulling at her, and I like the way that that heightened the conflict for Steph around everything that was going on in her life. Yeah. And it is political, and maybe that's because I was writing it during an election year.
Oh,
and that just kind
that.
Of bleeds in. I tried not to make it political, as in red versus blue, but rather he's a politician. And so he's very concerned about how his life looks to the outside world and how he appears to his voters.
You know, you've got Sammy and Ethan, the two boys that are like oil and water.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got Steph and Kat, but then you also have the mayor and his chief of staff.
Yes.
And it's his cousin.
Right. Yes.
So there were three very different scenarios with two people in each one that were totally different.
Yeah, and they all played off each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I love that. And that's why I intentionally made the chief of staff family, too, because if it was just a friend or, you know, family, you have ties that you can't really get around, that I thought made it so much stronger when they started to butt heads.
And I thought it was very telling that Sammy pointed out that maybe his dad was a bully, too.
Yes.
And maybe Josh was the person he was bullying.
Yes, yes, yeah. You know, kids learn from their parents. And so behavior is learned a lot of times. So Sammy said something, too, about how his dad lies all the time, right? And the dad says, those aren't lies. That's politics, right? I'm making a promise. And Sammy doesn't understand the difference. He's only 8 or 9, so.
And so you wonder how much they do pick up. My mother always said little pitchers have big ears.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I think they pick up way more than we think they're picking up.
Yeah.
For sure.
One of the things that really played into part of the plot was Sammy and Ethan's use of Xbox, because that's probably another way that they were against each other.
Exactly.
They were gamers.
Yes.
Did you have to learn the gaming language? Because it was like a totally different language to me. You may know that from your kids.
I do. My son, you know, he's a big kid now, but he's still a big Xboxer. So I would actually call him and I would say, okay, I need a game. Tell me the game. Which game do I use for this? How does it work? How do you talk to other people? Because you can really actually have a conversation with them. So he filled me in on all the Xbox stuff. But yeah, it's part of the plot because these kids, like I said, Sammy's a bully, and he's not just bullying Ethan in school, he's bullying him over Xbox and outside of the schoolyard. So it's definitely something that pushes the story forward, the part about them being on the Xbox.
I wanted to know more about Steph's mother. She was a very interesting character.
Yes.
I wanted to know her backstory. How did she go from psychiatrist?
Well, I put her in there to lighten things up. She is a woman who, like you said, she was a psychologist, and then she turns into this kind of Reiki, free thinking, energy healing kind of person. And so she's very much attuned to auras and energy. And she's always got, you know, I call them rocks, but they're not rocks, crystals in her pockets. She was there really to lighten things up because she is so very different than everybody else in the book and so very different than her daughter, Steph, who kind of thinks she's a little kooky.
Because Steph is so intense and her mother's just sort of a free spirit.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it was definitely a good balance between, you know, in those three women, Kat, Steph, and the mother, It's like you look at them all and you kind of compare, and it's like, yeah, you need somebody a little bit lighter because these other two women are so intense.
Exactly, exactly.
There were a lot of questions about Kat's husband, Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
With the abuse situation, would that have made Kat even more suspicious of his character? Because they couldn't get a hold of him. Mm-hmm. You know, you said that they try to call him on the phone. They find out that he's out of the country. But do you think that everything that she is feeling and doing with Andrew and really the whole situation is part of that abusive spouse syndrome, the way that she's looking at things? Does it color the way she looks at other people?
I think so. And I think that she's kind of on her way out of that. She's in a place where she's really figuring out how to take back her power from all the power that she handed over to Andrew over the years. And I molded her after one of my best friends who called me up one day out of the blue to say that her husband had beaten her and she had not told a single soul. I had no idea what was going on. She was one of my best girlfriends, still is one of my best girlfriends. Had no idea what was going on behind the closed doors of her home. And she would tell you if she were here, she said, that's kind of a blessing in disguise, the beating, because it forced her to come out of the closet.
It's very visible.
Yes, it was very, you couldn't get around it. I mean, it was the worst kind of beating. You've seen the images, you know what I'm talking about. But, you know, it was for her that moment where she asked for help and we rallied around and she changed her locks and had her husband arrested and took out a restraining order. And then she filed for divorce. And that's pretty much what happens to Kat in this book as well. So as I was writing this story, I was really channeling that girlfriend and putting what I knew of what she went through and where she was in the process. And that's really kind of where I put Kat in the process. So she was taking back her strength and she was coming out of this place where she, you know, she was starting to be independent again and really figuring out how to pick up her life and move on when this happens. When I channeled this girlfriend, I also channeled her ex-husband and turned him into kind of Andrew. So I knew what he was capable of. So does Kat. Kat knows what he's capable of. And of course, she immediately suspects him. I mean, any man who could do that to a woman could do something else bad. So she's definitely afraid that he's the one who took off with her son.
Well, she finally has the police officer, Mac, on her side as well, mm-hmm. once he gets to know her a little bit better.
Yes.
And he's really determined
yes.
to find this child.
He takes this case very personally, and he tells her that. He said, no matter what happens, I will bring him home. I will find him. So he's making promises he's not even sure he can keep, but he feels that strongly about this case.
And seeing what happens between custodial and non-custodial parents, we see that all the time.
Right. I don't remember the exact statistics, but we were talking before about the missing children and the amount of parental kidnappings are so huge. That's, of course, the first logical place you look.
And there were several plot twists that make you wonder, could he still be?
Yeah, even when he shows up and he is pretending or he's saying that he had nothing to do with it, you know, even then, he's definitely not a character that you can trust.
And he tricks her into coming outside when he knows that she has a restraining order and he's not supposed to be there.
Exactly. Yes.
And I really didn't like him.
No. Me neither.
Good. That's the way it's supposed to be. I noticed one of the things that you did was, you've got the bullying aspect, you've got the political. What lessons would you like for people to take away from this book?
Well, so, of course, there's the domestic abuse angle. There's also the what I mentioned before about Steph not being on the inside as what she projects to the outside world. So the discrepancy between perception and reality of a person and how sometimes you need to peek under the carpet and see what's hidden underneath to really know a person. But I guess my biggest takeaway from this story would be from something that came actually from my girlfriend. And she had given me, you know, front row seat to all the drama of her divorce. And she also gave me her blessing to use everything that I saw and heard in one of my stories. Because the way she feels is that she's one of the lucky ones. She got out. She took back her power. She got away from her abuser. And if her story, Kat's story, motivated even one other person to do the same, then she wanted me to tell it. So I hand my message over to her.
You've included a lot of good discussion questions at the back. Do you write those yourself?
I do, and I don't remember what they are, but yes, I do, which is really hard, by the way, because you're so close to a story, and then, I don't know, it's really hard to do for me.
That may be where you want somebody else to come in and say, okay, so what questions would you have about all of this?
Exactly.
Well, what was one of the most surprising things you learned? Because there was a lot in this, you know, from the Xbox to actually missing kids to dogs and all that. What did you learn that you really went, wow?
I think the most fascinating thing for me was the dogs and the scent and how wind and rain and all the weather can work against, and those dogs are still able to pick up a scent. And this was a campground in the middle of the woods. The kids had been playing in the woods all day, and still they managed to, out of all those kids' scents, they picked up a scent, and they were able to follow it through the woods. That is fascinating to me.
Well, what's next for you?
So I have just typed the end on a manuscript that I am very creatively calling book number 5. No title yet.
Makes sense.
And it is about a woman who is on the run. We meet her in the first chapter, and she is left home and taken almost nothing with her and has been planning this for many, many months. So she saved up some money, skimmed it off the grocery money, and she's just disappearing. She's first laying a trail, and then she's disappearing the other direction. Her chapters are interspersed with the chapters of a man who comes home from a business trip and finds his wife missing.
So you like that device between Steph and Kat enough that you kept it, even though it was confusing,
I know,
for you?
Right? Yeah. Well, this was male and female. You know, it was really funny. I started writing this, the next book, book number 5, and the male voice came to me so easily. I was like, maybe I should write men more often because he was really clear in my head, and I had his voice immediately, and the female voice took me a little bit longer to pick up. But it was easier to switch back and forth between the two because they were so distinctly different.
Do you usually write in first person?
Yes. I write all my stories. Almost all of my chapters are in first person, present tense.
Okay.
The only exception is in The Last Breath, my first novel. I had a story from, I think, 16 or 17 years in the past. And so I wrote that in past tense and I think third person. That does not come naturally to me. The natural for me is first person, present tense. I don't know why.
Because most people find that difficult because they want to be the, you know, the all-seeing, all-knowing.
Yeah.
Rather than just one.
Yeah. I like how it puts me right in their immediate head of the character that I'm writing. And you know what they're thinking, you know what they're doing at that very second, what they're feeling. And that just, for me, feels the most natural.
Well, I noted from your profile on the back that you do split your time between Atlanta,
yes,
and the Netherlands.
Yes.
And that you had spent a lot of time in Amsterdam. How did all that come about?
Well, I married a Dutchman. That's how.
Okay.
Yeah. So we met like at the tail end of college, and I had just graduated, and he said, do you want to come back to Holland with me? Because he had to write his thesis and graduate. And I was like, if there's ever a time to pick up and move, then now would be it. So we packed, like, I think we had 2 suitcases, and we moved to Holland, and we stuck for 12 years. Both kids were born there, and yeah, and his whole family still lives there, so we get back and forth a lot. And his business actually is split between here and there, so he's probably 5 or 6 times a year. And now that we're empty nesters, I get to go much more often. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's the reason you're able to split those personalities so much, because you're in between so much yourself.
Exactly.
Did you grow up in Atlanta so that you knew that area well?
I actually grew up in Tennessee. Yeah, I grew up in Kingsport. My parents still live there. I still get up that way quite a bit. And then I went to Atlanta to go to Agnescott. That's how I got to Atlanta and met the Dutchman, and the rest is history.
Well, it's lasted this long. I'm sure it'll continue that
exactly.
way. Do you think that you were kind of channeling what you would feel with your own children if you were in Kat's situation, were somebody's?
Yes. I don't know if I could have written this story when my kids were that age. It helps that mine are college age now. It gives me a little more distance between the fiction and the crossover into maybe real life. But yeah, you know, I'm a mother, and I actually don't think you even have to be a mother to put yourself in Kat's place. I think any loved one going missing would be excruciating. So, but yeah, I definitely channeled a lot of my motherly emotions to write this story.
Well, there was one part that you said, we pushed that back into the dustiest, most forgotten corner.
Right, right. No one wants to imagine that this would happen to them. Every mother carries this secret fear. I think that was the passage.
But in 3 days missing, yeah, this does happen.
Right.
And we're glad you were here to talk with us about
thank
it.
Thank you. Thank you for having
and,
me.
And we'll be interested to see what happens with the next one.
Yeah,
book number five.
Book number five. I promise it'll have a better title than that.
I'm sure it will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've reached the end of our time today. I've been talking with Kimberly Bell about her book, 3 Days Missing, published by Park Row Books. I'm Linda Lloyd, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.